Well, let's welcome you back to This Week in the Association. I'm Rob Pannier, joined once again by my good buddy Kevin Lucco. And this week, we are honored to have the manager of the South Division champions, Sioux City Explorers, Steve Montgomery. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
You know, Steve, before jumping into anything at all, I did want to kind of mention this just because it kind of took me by surprise today. I was out looking at the college football rankings today, and for some reason, I just didn't see Nebraska in the top five. I don't really understand that.
Yeah, there's not much that needs to be said. We know, you know, LSU is sitting at number one, who has an Ohio State quarterback now, so they're probably pretty good. And number two is Ohio State. And, three, I think, Clemson. Four is Georgia somehow. Georgia's there. I don't know how. But, there's no Nebraska there. There won't be a Nebraska there for another 5 to 10 years probably, forecasting. Let's just be honest. I say it all the time on the show, is that recruiting's nationwide now in college football, and they're just not a marquee name right now. Now, once I think they get this new facility they're talking about being built down there in Lincoln, I tell you what, there could be a good possibility that the tide changes a little bit and they become more attractive. But until then, it's going to be tough times there in Lincoln.
Well, what's going on? There's some hockey school that's in the top 10 now. They're back in the top 10 after about an 80-year hiatus. What's going on with that?
Yeah, the Gophers, man. PJ Fleck got them going a little bit. You know, big. I don't know if you want to call it an upset win. I guess you could call it an upset win just because Minnesota really didn't have a marquee win in their first 7 or 8 games, whatever it was. But you got to give them credit, man. They found a way to get it done against Penn State. It set them up beautifully in the West now. And, they should come out of that West division. And then, obviously, 2 weeks from now, the Big Ten Eastern champ will be decided between Michigan and Ohio State, notwithstanding that if Ohio State lays an egg against Rutgers, but I don't foresee that happening. But the winner of that Michigan and Ohio State game should go.
I was listening to the Minnesota Penn State game. I was driving down to Des Moines for hockey on Saturday afternoon, and it's in the fourth quarter, and Penn State gets the ball back. They're driving. I think they're like on the Gophers' 25-yard line. And I'm just sitting there thinking, because I followed Gopher football from a distance for my whole life, pretty much. And I'm just thinking, this will be such a Gopher thing to happen. I just kept waiting for the big play for Penn State to get the last second touchdown. And, just amazing that the Gophers came up with the big interception. And I don't know if you folks have seen it, but there was such a, they pretty much let everybody on the field. There was a couple of pictures. You couldn't even see there was a football field. It was just like a sea of maroon. So,
yeah.
Huge, huge deal up here.
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, when you think about football up in that region, obviously, North Dakota State comes to mind and what they've been able to accomplish at the FCS level. And Minnesota's putting it, PJ Fleck changed the culture there. And, it does take a season or two to change the culture. And, he's been able to do it, getting guys to buy into his system. And, they've had a wonderful year.
Yeah, it's really, it's a different kind of character. That's for sure. You really gotta be like a real open-minded person with PJ Fleck to really buy into what he's doing. But
who he reminds me of? He reminds me of a Joe Madden. He thinks way outside the box. He does crazy little stuff, like Joe Madden bringing in a zoo and stuff like that into the clubhouse and stuff. He does little things like that. He thinks outside the box, but he's one of those players that if you're on the outside, you're like, oh man, this guy's, I don't know about this guy. But then when you play for him, you'll run through a wall for him. So, whatever he's doing, man, he's got them all pulling on the same end of the rope.
I guess to relate it to independent baseball, a manager that he kind of reminds me of would be Mike Pinto.
Yeah.
As far as Pinto really gets his players to buy into this system down in Southern Illinois and almost recruits these guys to come in. And yeah, I just see a lot of similarity with Fleck and Mike Pinto.
Yeah.
Well, before kind of jumping in and talking about the past season, there's some big stories going on around sports, and no better guy to talk to about that than Steve Montgomery. So I kind of want to hear your thoughts on this whole Houston Astros situation with them asserting now that they were kind of cheating in 2017.
You're going to have to fill me in because I have not heard about this. So what were they doing? Were they stealing signs, or what were they doing?
Well, I guess according to Tom Fiers who pitched for them in 2017? Mike Fiers, okay. They were doing some things like they had a special camera that allowed them to steal signs, and they were smashing on garbage cans to let the batter know what exact pitch was coming and things like that. They were doing some rather shady kind of things there. Like a guy'd have an Apple Watch on his wrist that would beep or something to let him know what a pitch was coming or something. Wow. So that's some pretty serious stuff, I would think.
Yeah, that's huge allegations. I mean, with the advancement in technology, we're seeing it in our league. Every game is broadcasted over the internet. You can watch any game you want. What we have to figure out is Major League Baseball is going to have to go in, and they're going to have to time delay everybody. So, you know, let's say you are watching the game in the clubhouse or, you know, whatever you are, that the cameras inside of the club, inside of that broadcast, is on a 5 to 10 second delay. That'll handle everything in itself, because you're not going to be able to relay a pitch, you know, because a pitcher, once he gets the sign, 9 times out of 10 is going to throw it in within that 10 second window. So I think that's one thing. Secondly, you know, Some team is going to retaliate. There's no doubt about it. This upcoming season, and they're going to have to wear it a little bit. I mean, when you have allegations like that, and there's allegations that go run, you know, stealing signs at second base, stealing signs from the catcher, as a coach, if the catcher's wide open, you can see them. There's all kinds of stuff that you can do to cheat. But, you know, when you get caught, there's going to be not only is Major League Baseball going to come down on you, some other teams are going to handle it the way they want to handle it as well. And it's kind of those unwritten rules of baseball.
You know, I've been following this story as the day goes on, and I was watching MLB Network, and Billy Ripken was talking about how this has been going on for years, and you said at the old Comiskey Park, there would be a red light and a green light beyond center field where the batter could see it if he was looking for it. And those lights would tip off whatever pitch was coming in.
Right. You know, there's been times, I think, teams I've been on, that we pick up something that the pitcher is doing, or, you know, maybe the finger outside the glove, or he wiggles on his curveball, or, you know, kind of the same thing as the Rays guy was doing when, you know, everyone made a big deal about the glove position. It wasn't the glove position. If you watched his head on one of the pitches stayed down to the ground the whole time until he came set. And then he looked up. And then on the other pitch, he just looked right at the catcher the whole time. So everyone was saying the height of the glove. I didn't see that as much as I saw the head. The head was looking down on one of the pitches the whole time, and then the head would peek up quick. And I picked that up, actually, in his first game. And I was just like, man, he's tipping pitches here. What am I? But I could never, you know, when you're watching on TV and you got a sixth grader that's chirping in your ear, you kind of, you don't get to watch the game as intently. But I kept saying, he's doing something, man. I can see something. But then once all those things came out with the glove and everything, I picked up on the head is what I picked up. But, you know, there are guys, and, it's crazy to think that don't want to know what's coming. They get too big. They try to do too much with the baseball. Their swing gets long. You know, so whenever we pick up the telltale sign, which we have a book in Sioux City that, you know, if we do pick up a tip or something, we put it in this big binder thing that we keep. And there are guys who will be facing the guy and we say, okay, he tips his breaking ball, and who wants to know? And there'll be guys that walk out of the room that don't want to know that's coming. And that, to me, is kind of crazy. I'd love to know when a fastball or a breaking ball is coming, because I was kind of like Joe Boo when I swung the bat. I didn't like them curveballs.
Well, there was another player. It had to have been a former player. I didn't see who it was, but he said the same thing on there. He said he didn't want to know what was coming in. He just wanted to focus on the pitch that he was looking for, not what the pitcher was going to throw.
Right, right. But, you know, like, let's just say, you know, Kevin, that you are looking fastball, and all of a sudden you know the fastball's coming. Do you have the discipline to just stay within yourself and put a good swing on it, or do you get big? You know, and that's what hitters, learning hitters and, you know, getting in, you know, being a pitching coach and talking to hitters, and then, you know, coming into me being a manager, you talk to hitters, and the hitters that don't want to know all say the same thing. Yeah, we're looking for a fastball to the plate, but if I know it's coming, sometimes I get too big. So they all want to just stay within themselves and try to drive the ball that way.
Is that why a lot of guys want to take the 3-0 pitch, because they're afraid they're going to be swinging too big for that?
I think that's somewhat of it. I think sometimes it's a little bit of a fear of failure, maybe, on that 3-0 pitch, you know. But, yeah, I could see where guys try to get too big or the other thing, I think you got to, especially in our league with the advancement, you know, if you can remember, 10 years ago, let's just say, so that would have been 2009. If you had a guy throwing 92, like, he was throwing gas in our league. Now, 92 is like people are yawning at, because there's guys coming out of 10s that are 4 to 8 to maybe touching triple digits. So it's kind of crazy, and I think that what happens is that guys start focusing on halves of the play, okay? You know, you watch the game, okay, he's beating us in. We're going to go up there, we're going to sit on a fastball in. And I think sometimes on that 3-0 pitch, they're thinking, okay, he's got to go away. And, you know, that's not a ball I want to attack. You know, almost 3-0, almost always you see fastball put down away. And that's, I don't think that's a pitch they're looking for, per se, to drive the ball. If he locates it, if it moves a certain way, then they pop up or get themselves out, and they feel, you know, not bad, I guess, not the right word, but, you know, they just feel like they let the team down or let themselves down. And I think that's why you see so many people taking that 3-0 pitch.
Hmm. Interesting.
Now, I thought I saw last time I was in Sioux City, I thought I saw a guy standing on the go-kart track with flashlights on. So, are you hiding any little controversy here? Because you guys seem to hit really well at home.
Well, you know, here's the thing, is that everybody's built for their ballpark, right? And if you remember back in 14 when I took over, I built it all around power. I built it all around, you know, just home runs. And in the first, 20 home games, the wind blew in every game. I was like, what is going on? And in the preseason, we scored like 87 runs in 4 games. I'm like, holy moly, man, we're going to be pretty good offensively. Hopefully we can piece together the pitching. And it turned out being adverse. A reverse scenario, but you know, we build it around, you know, on base percentage guys, contact guys that are going to do the little things, you know. And if we hit a homer, it's like bonus for us, and the ball doesn't fly. And the crazy thing is like when I think of CHS Field in St. Paul, just the how beautiful it is and everything about it. But what I can recall about CHS Field is the wind kind of blows out to right center. Every time I'm there, it seems like the wind's kind of blowing out to right center. So there's that standardized wind that every time I play in CH Field, that if it's a normal day, that's where the wind's blowing. But at my field, it could be blowing out to left one day. The next, I will come out 2 hours later and it's bowing out to right or it's blowing in. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's how the bowl is shaped down there, but I can never get a consistent wind to know, you know, hey, this is how I have to build my team because of the wind per se, or how the ball flies to right or flies to left. It doesn't fly anywhere because on each night it's a different kind of wind.
Yeah, at CHS Field, we call that Shoemaker's Alley in right center.
Yeah, it's crazy. You get the ball up in that direction, and when you go out there, it does get deeper, you know, as you go, and obviously the wall itself is a mini monster, but it just seems like when that ball gets above that stadium and the wind's blowing in that direction, the ball just takes off. And I mean, just takes off. I remember the first time in 15, when we were playing St. Paul in the first round of the playoffs, you guys had a car parked out in left center field, and it was right in front of Mud's Dairy, that little concession stand area, right to the left of that side. And there was a car sitting there, and I told Brock Kelgard, I said, Brock, if you can hit that car, I'll give you $100. He goes, what, that car right there? I go, yeah, I want you to stick. Because what I was worried about with Brock was when we got there, he would kind of get pool happy because he knew the ball flew. So I wanted him to stay through the middle of the field. And when he was hitting them through the middle of the field, he was not only hitting them over in BP, that car, he was hitting it over Mud's Dairy. And I can just remember looking at Bobby and saying, man, you better keep the ball down because this is ridiculous. I mean, and you're talking about in just BP, guys just leaving the entire stadium. And I know Jose Sermo last year hit the base of the scoreboard in BP. And it's like, man, you know, the ball on just certain days at CHS, man, the ball really flies.
Wow. Well, let's ask you about this, Steve, because this is something that Kevin and I were talking a little bit before the show. I know you're kind of a big hockey fan as well, and both of us are a little stunned by the firing of Don Cherry. I don't know if you heard a little bit about this or not, but you know, from our standpoint, you know, we're thinking this was a little overzealous. I'm kind of curious about your thoughts about it.
Yeah, I read it on ESPN, and obviously Don Cherry. Been covering hockey since probably they wore no masks, and he's been around a long time. And you know, from what I read that he said, I didn't think that it was anything really over the top or like anything. He just wanted people to support this cause, and I think that's more so the message that he was trying to get out. It wasn't to bash anybody. It wasn't anything. He was just saying, hey, look. You know, we all need to be supporting this because this is something I truly believe in. And it goes from people that are lower class to people who have billions of dollars. We all need to support this. And, you know, and then he goes on and, you know, but that's the power of social media nowadays, man. You got to watch what you say. You got to watch what you text. You got to watch what you tweet. You got to watch all of that because, at the end of the day, somebody's going to find it. And it's unfortunate because that guy was hockey in Canada, and now it's no more, and all because of a cause that guy wanted. You know, I didn't find what he said offensive, but I don't understand as far as, like, what the support and what the cause was for. Because you obviously, I'm not up in Canada, and I just skimmed the article, but that's what I came away with it as, is that, you know, I think he was just more or less trying to get his point across just to support the cause.
Well, it was Remembrance Day in Canada on Monday, just like it was Veterans Day down here. And his point was that he wanted everybody buying poppies, because that's a big thing up there, to buy these $2 poppies to support the veterans. And he thought that the immigrants that have come to Canada, he finds it disappointing that none of them will buy poppies to support these veterans that provided, that gave their lives defending the country that they now get to call home.
Right.
So his quote was, you people that come here and, okay, so that was what got the liberals when you said you people. But anyone that has watched Don Cherry knows that that's for him, that's the way he talks. He'll talk about a player, an incident, and says, you people watch here. And it was just, that's just the way he talks. He wasn't, he did not mean it in a derisive way. It was just Don Cherry and the way he,
talks.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's very unfortunate, and, you know, it's, he probably didn't mean anything by it. He just, it's the same thing that we say here in the United States is that, you know, if I'm at a baseball game and I don't care where I'm at, I don't care what stadium I'm in, and in the third inning or the seventh, and or I could have just gotten a fight with the umpire, it doesn't matter. And they're honoring a veteran and they have the vet stand up, I make sure my team's on the top step. Because those are people that gave something that they're living, obviously, but they gave something that they can never give back. You know, we can't give back to them for what they gave us. And, you know, if it's a 30-second applaud and a standing ovation is what, you know, is what I can give, I'm going to give it to them. And, you know, I just think there's more that I think Canada could do. I think there's more the United States could do for these veterans, because we have a lot of veterans that suffer from a lot of different, you know, traumatic things that have happened to them in the past. And, you know, it's too bad we couldn't come up with something, you know, some sort of shelter or something, because you see a lot of homeless veterans and stuff like that. Something that, you know, the United States could do as a whole to kind of help these men that and women that gave so much for us.
You know, for those that don't watch Don Cherry, there's nobody better than him on his show. I mean, it wasn't even around Veterans Day. It was year-round, where if there was a soldier that died from Canada, he would mention it at the end of the show, and that's the way they would go out, with a moment of silence for the fallen soldier. He visited Canadian troops in Afghanistan. He's just a really ardent supporter of the military. So
right, and he used his platform. You know, because hockey gave him that platform, and he wanted to give back to those people. And if it was visiting them, if it was mentioning them, he was using his platform. And I don't think that Don Cherry meant anything bad by what he said. Like I said earlier, I think he was just, you know, some people took it the wrong way.
You know, Steve, I got to ask you, I don't know if you've ever seen Don Cherry on TV or something, but I'm wondering how you would look in a suit and tie like that.
I'll tell you, if a listener out there wants to get me a suit like that, I'll wear it. I'll wear it to a game, make sure that everybody's there. I'll wear something. Yeah, I got no problem. You know, especially like for a charity or something, you know, if we raise some money for a charity for Like the Veterans and someone wants to give me, well, I'll wear it all season. It does not matter to me. I mean, somebody will call me out, I'm sure, but It does not bother. That stuff to me, it does not bother me what people wear. You know, I'm the guy who, if we win and we're on a 10-game winning streak, I'm wearing the same clothes. So I'll wear it for 10 straight days. It does not bother me because, I mean, realistically, I go to the field and I get undressed, and then I take a shower and I get dressed, and then I go to my hotel or condo, and I take the clothes off and get in sleep clothes. So realistically, you're in your clothes less than 30 minutes a day anyway. So, but yeah, I would, especially to raise money for something of, you know, breast cancer or veterans or something like that. Absolutely. If a listener wants to make that crazy jacket and we'll get some donations going through the show, absolutely, I'm in.
We just need one for somebody at 6'10". Is that right?
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of material.
You know, there's a minor league teams have done it where they've worn jerseys that look like some of his sport codes.
Yeah, didn't Gary just do that or something, like with a tie or something?
I think Gary did it tied in with The Office.
Yeah, something like that, and they had like brown like vest jerseys with a tie or something.
Yeah, like Dwight Schrute.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'm in.
I think that'd be awesome. We did a lot of material. So fans out there, they keep that in mind there. Well, Steve, let's talk a little bit about stuff that happened in this past season for you, the Sioux City Explorers. So you guys kind of start out a little bit slow and then caught fire and took that all the way to the championship series there. So let's talk first of all about your overall thoughts on the past season.
Well, I mean, obviously, didn't end the way we wanted it to. But if you'd have told me after our first 25 games, after our first 10, that we would, or after our first series, to be honest, that we would have been in that position, I'd have said, you're crazy. You know, we got off to that such a slow start. We win opening night. Then Lincoln takes the next three from us. And realistically, in those ball games, it wasn't even close. They really just beat our doors off and start out 2-8. And then next thing you know, 9-16. And, you know, we're kind of scuffling a little bit. And I thought a big move for us was picking up Kyle Wren. We picked him up in that first St. Paul series, end of May. We were really struggling lineup-wise to have a true leadoff hitter. And everyone says, well, you only have one leadoff hitter a game. Yes, you do. But just a guy that could cause havoc on the bases, you had to worry about him. He had enough power to hit one out of the ballpark. He hit the other way. He bunted. He did everything that a prototypical leadoff guy could do for us, and a fantastic player and a fantastic person in the clubhouse. And, you know, when we kind of got him, and then we went through a little bit of the injury bug with Dean Green and a hamstring, and, you know, we had to bring in a replacement for him. And the crazy thing is just the – where I was on my salary cap, you guys wouldn't believe it if I told you. I was like, holy moly, I'm 2-8 and I'm so far out over my salary cap that all of a sudden at one point of the season, I was playing at almost $200 a day under my cap. And that's when we caught fire. And that's the crazy thing. I think we ran for about 30 days with 10 pitchers. And when we did that, yes, it was taxing, but it caught our number, and we were able to add some strategic pieces throughout the season, you know, getting, you know, when we sold Jason Garcia. And then, you know, we had already talked to Pete Tago in the offseason, and he wanted to start. And he was in York relieving, and then all of a sudden, he is just following us on social media, and he makes a phone call and says, yeah, you sold Garcia, you got that room. And I said, you know, Pete, I can't talk to you. Like, you're on another team, right? And I'm not tampering with you. Next thing you know, I get a call from his manager saying that he wants to be traded to us. And, you know, let's work out a deal because, you know, he wants to start and he was relieving in New York. So just little things like that kind of fell in our lap. And, you know, offensively early, we were not very good. Off the mound, we weren't very good. But what we had was, we had a pretty solid bullpen, and we felt pretty comfortable about when we got the lead after five or six innings that we could really piece it together. We had what we felt like was one of the best closers in the league, if not the best, and, you know, just get him the ball somehow in the ninth inning. But, yeah, it obviously with the sweep at the hands of St. Paul, you know, a championship well earned by George. I thought George, he had my vote for manager of the year. Just the moves he made, I thought down the stretch really catapulted him in to, into that top spot. But, you know, I mean, down 5-0 in the sixth or seventh inning of game three and find a way to win. And we just never could get the momentum away from him. I mean, we just couldn't. I mean, no matter what, it just felt like, you know, the first game, let's just, they beat us. They just flat out just beat the drums off of us. And you come game two, you got the lead. They somehow figure out a way. You know, we're trying to execute a breaking ball. We hang it, hit down the left field line. Next thing you know, you lose the game. And then in game three, obviously, you know, the big story was, and, you know, what was wrong with Gerken down the stretch and everything. And, you know, Girk was coming off an injury that he had 9 months to recuperate, and this season, and he was just starting to get tired, and the ball was flattening out. But you know, we had thrown a bullpen earlier that day. The sink was back in the sinkers. Just, you know, Chesney Young, you know, beat him to the spot, and had that big slam, and just could never recover.
Well, I want to ask you a little bit. What step back in the season just a little bit? Because one of the biggest concerns I had about Sioux City early on was Jose Cermo had such an amazing season for you in 2018, and I wondered, was he kind of feeling the pressure to deliver that same kind of season? Because he got off to such a slow start.
I think so. I think you know, Jose put a lot of pressure on himself, and I, you know, the one thing I told him when he arrived the first year in Sioux City and he had the MVP year, is I don't want you to hit homers, Jose. I want you to look at your numbers throughout your career. I said, look at Gary. He had 20 doubles. That's all I want. Just go out, hit the ball, square the ball up. You have natural loss to your swing. So if you miss hit the ball by a half inch, it's going to be a homer instead of a double. So just try to hit doubles. And obviously he had that fantastic year. And then you know, obviously he wants to get back to an organization. So all, you know, all the calls we made in the offseason and everything was he's got to get a better glove. He's got to, you know, the glove. We heard the same thing everywhere. And so he really concentrated a lot on his glove this year. And, you know, that might have taken a little bit away from his offense. But I just think that overall, I think, Rob, you guys hit the nail right on the head. It's just a guy that felt the pressure being the reigning MVP and wanted to go out and have another MVP type season. And, you know, no one's going to hit 20 doubles and 20 homers every single year. It's just not going to happen. And, you know, when he settled down and just was himself, you look, he carried us pretty much in that Kansas City series. And then you look at the year prior, he was non-existent after that solo home run in the first game. So, just tale of two seasons for Jose, but yeah, he put a lot of pressure on himself, but you know, I'll go to battle with Jose, in my corner, on a baseball field for a long, long time. That guy's work ethic is unreal. He comes to work, whether he's 0-5, and here's the thing about Jose, is that if he's 0-5 and the team wins, Jose's happy. If he's 3-4 with 2 homers and 5 RBIs and we lose, Jose's not happy. He's very much a team-oriented guy, and at the end of the day, he wants to win just as bad as the rest of us.
I got to ask, how big of a luxury is it to plug in Nate Sampson in your lineup every day?
Oh, it's unbelievable. I mean, what he means to me as a manager, I've never, if you think about it, one year is the only year I've not had Nate Sampson in a Sioux City uniform was 2015. And, you know, 2014 we had him and then we pulled him. And then he came back to us in 16 and we've had him since 16. But yeah, he's the utmost professional. He goes about his business the right way. You never hear a peep from him. He's my clubhouse leader. He's the guy that when something's wrong in the clubhouse, will take care of it himself before it leaks to me or anything like that. And you just can't say enough about that guy. And he needs a shot. He needs a chance. You know, I've been lobbying for him for 3-4 years now just for someone to give him a spring training invite. Let him show what type of player he is. You know, at higher levels, he's a utility type player. He can play left. He can play right. He's a Ryan Court is what he is. And he can play first, second, short. I mean, if you told Nate, hey, we'll give you a Triple-A job if you caught, I guarantee Nate would work on catching the full off season. And that's what kind of guy he is. And very, very, it's very easy when you have Nate Sampson because this, for instance, this year he plays with like a crack in his wrist. No one knows it, but he played with it. And he played with it for like 2 weeks. And that's when, if you remember, he was hitting like 350, 360, and all of a sudden he went down to like 310. And that was all because of that injury. And he just played through it. He just said, hey, look, you know, I know I'm making decent money. and you need me in the lineup. I'm going to do it. And then we would pull him out, and we strategically gave him a day off before an off day to have him give him 48 hours of rest on that rib. But he's a gamer. He's a gamer, and he's a real pleasure to have around.
Well, I like the All-Star game in St. Paul was having Nate's mic'd up where viewers got a chance to know a little more about Nate Sampson, the person, as opposed to just the player.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, his wife is fabulous. He's got a little baby girl who's beautiful. And, you know, they live about 45 minutes away from me here. So, you know, he'll come every once in a while to a facility that I go to up here, and he'll come in and hit. And, you know, we have that Rapsodo hitting machine. So he comes up, makes sure his exit velo and all that stuff still on cue. But, yeah, he's a very much a fan. You talking about the utmost professional off the field. He's what Brady Shoemaker is to St. Paul. That's exactly what he is, and the utmost professional. Anytime someone wants an autograph, he signs it. You know, he'll give you the shirt off his back, and you know what? At the end of the day, it seems like he's always the dirtiest guy on the field.
You know, this isn't a term I throw around about a lot of guys, and Kevin can tell you there's probably three that come to mind. But I just find him to be one of the best guys I've ever met. You know, I mean, it's just a guy that you could talk to at any time. You know, he's never down about stuff. I want to use this as a great example because a couple of years ago, you guys were playing, I think it was the last game of the season in St. Paul, and you had a bunch of injuries where your pitcher was DHing and you're like nine guys is all you got available. And a really bad call is against him at home plate. And he turned around like he was really going to let the umpire have it. And you could see in his brain, he realized, I can't get thrown out of here because there's literally no one to replace me. And I thought, wow, that's just a really heads up guy.
Yeah. You know, that all, you know, I have a meeting at the beginning of the season, and I try to explain to them that if you get tossed and you get thrown out, the only person you're hurting are the people inside here. You're not hurting me. You're not hurting the fans. The only people you're hurting is your teammates because, let's be honest, there's 22 guys on a roster, on most teams, sometimes 23, sometimes 21. And, you know, if we get a Nate Sampson thrown out of the game, then Nate Sampson, well, I don't have another Nate Sampson on my bench. So the only people you're hurting is yourself. So we try to really limit that. But there are times when, you know, Nate will come up to me and be like, this is ridiculous, man. I'm getting just some terrible calls against me. And I'll just, you know, in the eighth inning or something, game's decided. Hey, man, if he gives you a bad call, let him have it. Go ahead. Let him have it. This is your chance. And, you know, almost always it happens, you know. It's just, you know, that's just, you know, letting him get his due in and, you know, then just making sure it doesn't escalate to where we get a suspension or anything and just let him have his due. So, you know, but yeah, I think he's been kicked out maybe two or three games his whole career. So, just a fabulous person.
Totally. I know the guys in Cleburne wanted him thrown out of the game last year. I believe there was a play at home plate where Nate didn't slide. From what I saw, and I was watching the game live online, he was going hard in the home plate. He didn't slide, but you could also tell he let up at the end.
Right. I can't recall that play. Was it at their place or our place?
I think it was down there.
Yeah, I can't recall that play, but if they thought it was anything dirty, he's the last guy to do something dirty.
I mean, right, and that's what I thought.
Yeah, he'd never, he probably went to go around somebody, thought he could, you know, and the whole thing is that you gotta see the whole camera angle, where's the guy on deck telling them to go, and everything like that, so, I've never seen him, and we had the Major League rule for 3 years, and I never saw him truck a catcher once. So, I can't recall it though.
Yeah, from what I saw on the replay, he let up at the end, and he even checked on the catcher right away after the collision. But it was, I just thought Cleaver kind of made more of a deal of it than it really should have been. So, but this tells you, yeah, you know, he's a smart cookie.
Well, Steve, let's talk a little bit about that championship series, because I want to ask you about this. 2 years ago, we watched George Samus. You know, he was doing the same moves he'd done all season long to great success, turns to his bullpen in the championship series, and things just didn't work out for him. You're doing the same things this year. You know, you're turning to, you know, Matt Poverinko in the end, and you're, you know, going through your bullpen. Everything looked like it should go exactly the way it had gone for you all season long. How does that feel for a manager when they're just not going that way, though?
You know, you've worked so hard to get to that, you know, where there's two teams standing. It's just you and another team are the only two teams that are left, and, you know, you have that game plan in place. You got all the numbers in front of you. Who's pitched well against St. Paul? Who hasn't? What their lefties are hit. I mean, I'm a numbers just guru when it comes to that stuff. I probably over prepare, but you know, it's just, what can you do sometimes? I mean, when you run, I always say that it's harder to get in the playoffs than it is to win. All you got to do is get hot in the playoffs. If you can get hot at the right time, you win the championship. And I think it's no better way to explain what St. Paul did. They got hot, and they were firing on all cylinders. And it wasn't like one guy. I mean, we held down Shoemaker in the championship series. But it was other guys. And and Shoemaker was the one that killed us in the regular season. So, you know, everything that you do and you prepare, and then all of a sudden, it's just not working out. And we even tried, like, I contemplated bringing Poverinko into the game in the, I think it was the sixth inning, maybe, that when we brought Gerken in to face Chesney Young, that even ran through my mind of bringing him in. But then you sit there and you're like, hold on, you know, I have a guy that, you know, 74% of the time, he gives up a ground ball, you know, and this is perfect situation. And I brought him in, and it just didn't work. And, you know, hindsight's always 20/20. You know, oh, I shouldn't have done that then, that situation. But the numbers, the everything in my mind told me I needed a ground ball in that situation, bring in my guy with the power sinker. And that's what I did. And you know what? You got to sometimes credit the other team. He got the ball up in the air and, you know, was able to drive it out of the park. But it's very frustrating. There's no doubt. I think George would second that when you have a bullpen like that and you go to it and all of a sudden it just doesn't work out. It's like, what can you do? I mean, you're trying to make moves. You're trying to do everything in your power to keep the game where it's at or keep a lead or keep a one-run deficit. And then, you know, something unforeseen happens, and you just can't control it, and it's frustrating as a manager. But at the same time, you go back to the regular season. You had games you should have won that you lost, and you had games that you lost that you ended up, or you should have lost and you ended up winning. It's baseball. At the end of the day, it's just baseball, and you know, we just didn't have enough.
Now, rolling back into the regular season, into the first round of the playoffs, you guys had 10 out of 13 games against Kansas City. Do you think, and they were all, you know, high-stakes games, do you think that took a little bit out of your team, or was that not a factor going into the championship series?
Oh, I think no doubt that took a little bit out of us. We were playing playoff baseball from August 1st on, and really from the All-Star break. You know, the All-Star break happened at a very good time for us. A very good time, I should say, but then at a very bad time, because we were playing really good before the All-Star break. We had just we just played Sioux Falls, and we had that rain-delayed game, and we had swept the four-game series, and then the two games off, and then I think we had Gary in for three, and then Texas in for three. So we knew we had to take care of business because, you know, those two teams were not at the forefront of the standings and stuff like that. So we had to take advantage and win series. And we were fortunate that we swept that Sioux Falls series, swept the Gary, swept the Texas. Next thing you know, we're on a 10-game winning streak. And that put us right back into the race. And then from there on, from like the second week in August all the way out, it was just Cleburne and Kansas City on our schedule. That's all there was. With like a sprinkled in somebody, I can't remember who it was, but that was sprinkled in. And then it was sprinkled in somebody else. I think we had two series from August 1st through the end of the season that wasn't Kansas City and wasn't Cleburne. So we knew the destiny was in our own hands, and we pushed a lot. And then, you know, you think about the emotional roller coaster that we're on. You know, we come into Kansas City the last four games, and I think we had a game lead or maybe a two-game lead. I don't know what it was. And then we lose three in a row. And then all of a sudden, all the eggs are in one basket. And fortunately for us, Lincoln takes care of business against Cleburne, and they lost to, I think, Fargo. And, you know, we're winning, get in. And, you know, that kind of hurt. And I think not only did it hurt us in the long, it hurt us setting up our rotation. You know, we had to, instead of, we really taxed our bullpen down the stretch. I mean, that's all there is to it. We taxed them. And then you think about what, you know, Poveretto did in game four. I think he pitched four innings. He did that three times this year, twice late in the season to get us W's. And, you know, our guys probably, tongues were hanging out a little bit. But that's a good point that you don't think of, because that's in the rearview mirror once the playoffs start. But yeah, that's an excellent point that we probably were a little tired, but no excuse, you know. St. Paul beat us, and you know, we just got to figure out a way now this year for the 2020 season to get back there.
Yeah, I was at the last three games in Kansas City, and I tell you what, those from a guy just watching the ball game, those two games on Saturday night and Sunday night was just incredible baseball.
Yeah, we're two really good teams, you know, fighting for something. And you know, it's just, we got help there. I mean, no doubt about it. Fargo, you know, won on that Sunday, which, you know, we knew going into the game because I believe our game was a little later, in that day. And, so we knew it was all going to come down to Monday. And then, you know, we were just fortunate that it lined up that Pete Togo was going to take that ball, in a win and you're in scenario. And, but yeah, both teams were so familiar with each other. I think that's why you saw, you know, Kansas City in the first game, everything they hit fell, found a hole. And then in game two, same scenario. Everything we hit found a hole. And so you had two blowouts in the first two games, and those last two games in Kansas City were really quality baseball games. It was, you know, we didn't get to their bullpen till like the ninth inning, I think. And then obviously their bullpen pitched fabulous. And who knows, man, if they don't lose that lefty with a knee injury in the, like the 11th, I mean, I thought he was going to go another inning or two, and then that pushes their guy back. And then Poveretto, the only reason he pitched the last inning, the only reason was because we took the lead. And when we took the lead, he came flying up out of the dugout and he says, "I want the ball." And, you know, rightfully so, he deserved it.
I thought it was kind of a funny irony when the 2020 schedule came out and here the first series for you in 2020 is going to be against Kansas City.
I think it was like 13 of our last 16 were against Kansas City. So if you think about it in terms of last year, so 13 of 16, so then that would have been four more, 17 of 20, and then we played St. Paul, so 17 of 23. So we'll have our last 20, our last 26 are against Kansas City. So, but, you know, I mean, you know, does a great job down there, and, you know, he's going to have a good quality team, and, you know, got to get it off to a good start.
You know, talking about the 2020 schedule, what are your initial thoughts on it? See, we're back to a balanced schedule once again.
Yeah, I like the balanced schedule. No one has a complaint. Yeah, you know, you're going to have a little bit of imbalance a little. But I mean, if it's one game or three games or four or five, that's okay. When it starts getting that 15, 20, you can't have that in our league. And, I spend less time on the bus this year, so I'm all about our schedule. I love it. We go to Texas twice this year. Last year, we went three times, and every time we went down, we came right back. So this year, we go down, and we hit Cleburne, and we have a day off going down, and we hit Cleburne and Texas, and a day off coming back both times. So I can't complain about the schedule. I think we have the least amount of miles traveled in 5 or 6 years since maybe I've taken over. So the schedule makers really did a good job, I felt, for hitting the team. And I call them travel partners. You know, when you hit Fargo, you should hit Winnipeg. When you hit St. Paul, you should hit Milwaukee. When you hit Gary, you should hit Chicago. You know, the two Sioux are connected, Kansas City and Lincoln, and then Texas. So I'm a big proponent for that. That when you go on the road, hit the travel partner, because it, you know, my biggest fear is that we have so many overnight trips. It's just that bus driver falling asleep, and the least, you know, the least amount of overnight stuff we can do, the better. Especially when you got to play the next day, it's just very nerve wracking to me.
Well, we'll be thankful that the commissioner isn't sitting there with a pencil and a notepad anymore, figuring out the schedule. Maybe that's why it came off a little bit better this year. So
I haven't talked to other managers in the league, but I'm sure other managers are probably feeling that the schedule's pretty good.
Well, I want to ask you, coming out of this championship series, though, Steve, because you joked with me, I think, in 2017. And we were talking a little bit about the 2015 series, and I was asking you at that point, you know, how long did it take you to kind of get over your disappointment or your feelings of disappointment about that series? And you were like, I'm still not getting over it. I mean, do you feel like, is this a little bit different feeling because you kind of got off to a slow start and because you guys really battled to get there? It wasn't like a dominated all year. This was, you guys worked really hard to get to the championship series. Is there a better satisfaction out of that?
I still want to bring Sioux City their first championship, and the only way you can do that is by being in that championship series and winning it. So that's my goal. I don't make no secrets about it. But you got to keep putting yourself in that situation. And then I couldn't believe it, and I never really thought about it. That was St. Paul's first championship since, I think, 2004.
Was.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so since 2004. So I'm thinking 15 years, you know, it took probably the most recognizable franchise in independent baseball history. 15 years in between them, you know, I keep putting myself in that situation. I mean, eventually a call or a ball's got to have a bad hop in it if we keep getting there. I've thought about it. You replay those games in your head. I do all the time. In fact, I just had a conversation with some guys I coach with down here with my son's high school and stuff like that. And I said, you just sit there and you think of, you know, woulda, coulda, shoulda, and it just, I felt like I made every move that was necessary to kind of win games, but it just didn't happen. You know, I look at, you know, Kyle Wren in the ninth inning, we're down three runs, hits a ball right on the screws. He just hits a little bit too much on top of the ball, and it's a bullet, but it's right at Allen for a double play. And, you know, it just, what can you do? It's still going to leave a bad taste in my mouth, and it'll be there for a while, as it is. But, you know, once you put the uniform on for 2020, you can't look back on what happened in 2019. You got to move forward and try to put yourself in that situation again. And, you know, the more playoff games you manage in and you're a part of, I think the easier they become, you know. That first one at 15, I put a lot of pressure on myself. 16, I put a lot of pressure. 17, we didn't make it. 18 and 19, you know, a little bit less pressure on myself. And just let the guys go out there and perform and just make sure as a manager you're prepared. And, you know, I am due diligent with my coaching staff that we put together game plans, scouting reports. We do everything to put our players in a spot to succeed. And if we can keep doing that, hopefully we can bring a championship sometime back to Sioux City.
I think this is year 7 for you and your 9-year deal coming up here. And before we kind of talk about that a little bit, I think you and I were discussing in like July or August that you already in 6 seasons have over 320-something victories, 330-something victories at this point. And that's quite a mark for a guy who's just, you know, getting his first managerial job, first opportunity to build his own team. I hope there's some satisfaction for you in that.
Yeah, there is. There, you know, we've, I can't remember. It was either you or Kevin had said on a previous show that something about changing the culture in Sioux City. And this was back when you guys first started this show. So it was a couple of years back. And I thought that was hitting the nail right on the head, is that, you know, it wasn't about, obviously it's about getting better players. It's about, you know, doing, but it's also about how the players think when they leave that clubhouse. And I do nothing but preach to them that I'm going to do everything in my power to help you get back, to help you get another chance at MLB. Just look at the number of players we've been able to move. Us in Kansas City probably lead the league in players moved over the past 5 years. But while you're here, win me as many games as you can. And that's kind of what I preach, and, do what you can to help us win a game tonight. And, we have some guys that have bought in, and really have made their stamp on, Sioux City baseball. But the personal accolades are great, but it's all about the players in my regards. It's the players have won 300 and whatever it is the total is, and, I've lost 200 and some. So, I take the blame and I want them to have it, because I don't swing a bat, I don't take a walk, I don't throw a pitch. All I do is prepare them, and so definitely I know it goes on my record, but you know, the players are the ones that that really deserve all the credit.
You know, for a lot of us that talk, when Sioux City's mentioned, we mentioned the success on the field and the players getting signed. But the thing that baffles us is that the city just doesn't seem to come around to going out to Explorers games, and I just find it really puzzling. I don't know if there's a heck of a lot going on outside of Explorers baseball. I just don't get it.
I live there for, you gotta realize, I get up there in April. I think Rob knows this. I was up there April 1st last year because, you know, our longtime general manager, Shane Tritz, resigned, and, you know, we didn't have a general manager, and our grounds guy resigned, so I was up there getting the field ready, and I played grounds crew guy for the first month and a half of the season. You know, I was it, you know, and one of my bench coach, the new coach, Derek Wolf, came out, Bobby Post came out, Matt Pazzarelli, so the whole coaching staff was there, and we were working on the field, and I thought, at that time, I thought that really brought us together as a coaching staff, okay? And I'm kind of going off beat, and I'll get back to it. But that kind of brought us together as a coaching staff. Here we are, and name one other professional staff in all of professional baseball that is also the grounds crew. So you're not going to find one. But we did it all year long. And then when we hired Boyd Pipkin, longtime Briar Cliff head coach, he helped out on the field, and we just all – kind of pulled, you know, hey, this needs to be done. Okay, I'll do this, you do that. And, you know, I was at the field every day at 9 o'clock. Shoot, I was watering the infield sometimes at 10 o'clock. after I'd look for players and stuff like that, I'd go out, hey, what needs done? Da-da-da, and I'd work on the field for an hour and a half. But I don't know what else, and it's not my area, I guess, because I can't control what's being done in the stands. But as far as on-the-field product, I don't know what else more we can do. I mean, we've had success. You know, I will say this, is that we are one of the better cities that when we do make the playoffs, we get pretty decent crowds. I will say that, you know, because there's some places you go to, I mean, they have 400 or 500 people in the playoffs. We're at least getting 1,000 to 1,200. So when we do make the playoffs, they do come out in a little bigger than what we're normally average. But I don't, I just don't know what else we could do. Now I know our front office is working on a different kind of strategy to kind of attack, the Sioux City public. But, you know, hopefully that works out and, they'll come out, because I think what they're truly missing is if you look back in the '90s and the 2000s, they used to draw 2,500, 3,000 every night, and they would average that. And you think about how the league has evolved just in the play itself. I think anybody who hasn't been in the game since, let's say, 2005, 2010, because you're just thinking it's same old Sioux City Explorers baseball, are gravely mistaken. I mean, if you would have came to a 2018 game, you'd have saw a guy in uniform that pitched in the big leagues last year. And if you would have, you know, we had three guys, a 16, a 15, and an 18, alumnus from our teams made it to the big leagues last year. And we have another couple that are knocking on the door. Ian McKinney was named California League Pitcher of the Year. I mean, it's just crazy the amount of talent that we have there. And I just wish that, you know, somebody would stop what they're doing on a Friday night and just come out to a game. Just one. If you don't like it, so be it. That's fine. But just come out and check out the level of play. Because I think you'd be really, it would be eye-opening just to see what level of play is being played in the American Association on a nightly basis.
And what I find incredible, too, is that when you have your fireworks spectaculars, you get great crowds come there. And I'm just thinking, well, why aren't they coming back?
Yeah, I mean, we get, I think the one, we had the biggest crowd, I think it was 2 years ago, in Explorer history, and that was minus, I guess they had a game back in like the early 90s or the late 90s, excuse me, that maybe Hootie and the Blowfish and July 4th was tied in at the same time, and they had like at the old St. Paul, I played a game where they had people on the stands, they put up on them snow fences, and they had people on the field.
Yeah,
they did
that
in Sioux City as well. But we had 4,600 like 2 years ago on a July 3rd, and then we always get, you know, another 3,000 on July 4th. I guess we got to set off firecrackers every night, you know, but.
Or have some guys in the team form a band.
Yeah, there you go. I have no idea. I really don't. You know, because the people that I see in the community and that I talk to inside the community, whether it's schools, whether it's, you know, they're always requesting that we come, so they know who we are, and they support us, and they want us to come to their school. So you're never really dealing with the outside public in a manner of what can we do. And I would love to take suggestions from the community. I mean, what can we do that's better, and what can we do that'll put you That'll have you come out to five games a year. That's it. And if we can figure out what that is, I'm all for it.
Yeah, Macy, I almost wonder if you get like get some interns, marketing interns, to put a questionnaire together, send it out to get a mailing list of everybody in Sioux City, and say we're here. What would it take for you to come out to a game? And that'd be the best way to get suggestions.
Yeah, it would be. That wouldn't be a bad idea, you know. And the sacrifices that, you know, our owner makes it's unreal. I mean, what he does. Yeah, I mean, the guy, you know, I love the guy. like a family member and gotten to know him over the years. You know, you hear certain things about people and stuff like that, but once you get to know someone, his heart's in the right place. And he's a very genuine guy. I know sometimes he comes off as, you know, to the outside public as kind of harsh and stuff. But when you get to know John, he is almost like a father to me. You know, I lost my dad in 2000 to cancer, and you know, he would give me the shirt off his back. I know he would. And obviously, after the team season, you know, signing me up for that 9-year deal, I thought he showed a lot of commitment to me, my family, to my coaching staff, and to my beliefs on how I wanted to run Sioux City Explorer baseball in the future. And I couldn't be more grateful.
You know, I hardly give away every homestand.
There you go. And I listen, we'd rig it up so I win it.
And, and then just have like all these alias names.
And then I'm riding a hog around Sioux City. And listen, I joke around with, you know, because obviously the two companies are kind of tied in, obviously. And so they'll have the general manager lives like real near me. And I see him all the time. And he last April, they had some event that they were having at the Harley shop. So I go running down. I want to check it out. I'm telling you, there is no chance you will ever see me on Harley Davidson. Those things are too powerful. They are scary to me. And like they were telling me that you like lean the opposite way when you turn, and I'm like, no. This body isn't flexible enough to do that, so I'm out. Now, give me one of those three-wheeled things. We'll put me and Rob in the sidecar, and Kevin, you can drive me and Rob around, and that would be a good story too on the three-wheel cart.
I like it. You know, I want to say too. I really liked Kevin's intern idea about kind of putting a questionnaire out there. I'm kind of wondering if that grounds crew might have a few extra minutes that they could work on that. Is that possible?
Yeah, you know, hey, I was thinking about doing the YMCA during the field drag, you know. Yeah, I mean, you know, listen, we had to do what we had to do to get through this year. You know, the resigning was real late of Shane, and we've had to do what we had to do, and we got through it, and somehow had a pretty successful year doing it.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people realize this, but for those of you who don't know, Steve and I do a weekly podcast show about kind of what's going on with the Explorers. And I think there was one day that I called you. You were on the lawnmower working on the field at that point or something. We were trying to figure out if we could do the show. We had to wait a little bit, but it's just crazy. So
yeah, well, I actually lost a whole set of keys to the stadium this year, the entire set, like everything. We don't have one master. We have a bunch of keys because obviously our stadium was built in 1993. So there's a lot of different keys to different things. And the one thing that our president, Matt Adamski, has done is he's segmenting off into, we're going to have one key that's going to control getting into the clubhouse and into the assistant coach's room. And then one key. My key will open up the clubhouse, will open up the assistant, and it'll open up mine, but the assistants can't open mine. So he's doing some things with keys that I don't really understand, but he's, you know, we're taking a key fob of, let's say, 30 keys, and we're going to break them down into like 5, which is better for everybody. But I was actually mowing the field this year, and I have this big set of keys on me, and I'm mowing, and I'm doing patterns, and I'm doing everything, you know, trying to make the field look pretty. And doing the patterns, next thing you know, I'm like, oh, where's my keys? I can't find my keys. I'm like, oh, my gosh, I dropped them. Well, if I dropped them, I would have heard myself run it over with the mower. So I go and I look in the outfield, can't find it. Here, what had happened was, and we didn't find it for about 2.5 months, they had fallen underneath one of the seats. I guess the seats come up on these mowers, and it had just lodged underneath the seat. So, you know, it will give me some heck for it, but. You know, hey, it was pretty designed.
Wow. Well, I'm kind of curious, you know, you got a few guys there that are, Nate is still as skilled as ever, but, you know, he's reaching 30 there. And I know Dylan Kelly was kind of a late sign for you last year. Are you expecting some changes, or are we going to see a lot of the same faces in 2020?
You know, you're going to see changes just because I think you're going to see some guys maybe going to Mexico, making some money now. And, you know, I'm hoping to, you know, obviously Pete Tago's signing. You know, Nate's going to figure out what Nate's going to do. And obviously we'd love to have Nate back, but, you know, I'm sure there's 11 other teams that are all over him as well. And, you know, we have to just figure out moving forward what's the best fit for us. And, you know, we're keeping an eye out on the free agent market, obviously, and trying to figure out. But, you know, I kind of let my guys that are under contract kind of be until Thanksgiving because, you know, you talk to them all. I have exit interviews. You know, everyone's going to play next year because it's just the season just ended and they want to play tomorrow. But, you know, I let them kind of get away from it, and then we'll start talking to them around Thanksgiving here in about 2 weeks and start re-signing people up and seeing who wants to play out their options. And, you know, looking back at that series, too, another big thing, and I don't know how much of the press caught of this and stuff, was the loss of Carlos Sierra for us. You know, when we lost Carlos Sierra, he pitched game one against Kansas City, and he was no longer with us. We didn't let anybody know that, but he had to go to Team Spain in that Olympic qualifier. I think the Team Israel won over somewhere over in Europe. So that was a big loss to us too, because we felt as though, you know, he was one of our main starters as well, that helped us get there, and obviously was in the top 10 in pitching. And that just came to my mind, so I thought I'd throw that out there.
There were a couple guys that do a podcast that knew about it.
Yeah, they didn't mention it anywhere, but
I appreciate that.
As a matter of fact, I remember that you and I talked about that a little bit about whether the league was going to allow you to bring somebody else in. I don't think we ever had an answer. Did they allow you to replace him? They did.
I was not allowed to replace him because it was after the roster freeze. My argument was is that, you know, I don't control what dates these things fall on. And, you know, it's a shame that it had to happen then, but how am I going to tell a kid that he can't go and play in an Olympic qualifying event, that if he wins, he's in the Olympics? And I just felt like I could not do that to him. And he told me it was up to me. He says, if you say stay, I'm safe. If you say I can go, I'm going to go. And, you know, I said, let me think about this. And then at the end of the day, it's the Olympics. You know what I'm saying? It's the Olympics. And he has a chance to represent his country. And I know what it meant for me back in 2002 to put on that Team USA jersey. And you know what? At the end of the day, we got to do what's right for the kids. And, you know, we let him go.
You know,
you can thank Winnipeg for that rule.
But
well,
the thing,
Winnipeg was able to replace their guys because it fell in the regular season.
Well, you so see, this goes way back to, I believe it was 2003. And in game one of the playoffs, Harry Berrios of Winnipeg got injured. And Winnipeg thought that they could go make a trade the next day to bring in Bubba Smith. Remember Big Bubba Smith, power hit DH. Yeah, they wanted to bring him in, make a trade, and have him on the roster for the playoffs right away. And obviously Salmons complained, and the league agreed, and after that the rule came in about the roster freeze the next year. So in a roundabout way, you can blame Winnipeg.
Steve, I just want to say, the thing I don't really understand. Okay, forget kind of the opportunity for Carlos Sierra and everything else around it. I'm just going to look at, from a league standpoint, if this guy goes off to go play for Team Spain somewhere, he's pitching independent baseball across the globe. Why you don't want to help out a team to allow a guy to go do that and still keep their roster intact doesn't make sense, because this is great for American Association Baseball.
Well, they said that they want them to do that. It's just that it was unfortunate when the tournament was. The tournament was during our playoffs.
And it also cost Kansas City Calabello.
yeah, it cost them Colabello and everything like that. So, I don't know. Yeah, I have to do what the league, you know, says the rules are. And, there's no rule in place for that. There was just a roster freeze date. You know, there wasn't a specific rule that said, hey, look, if your guy goes to international competition, no matter what date it is, you can replace him on the roster. And listen, it's not like I was trying to go out and bring Pedro Martinez, you know, out of retirement or Mike Mussina. I just wanted a rookie arm just so I could make it and not put so much stress on my other guys. That's all I was looking to do. Now, he pitched game one of the playoffs, don't get me wrong. So, in theory, he missed six games, okay? So, he missed maybe one start, in theory. But, and you look back at the Kansas City series, the game five starter, do you know who that would have been? Now, I want you to think about game four. It went 13 innings.
Yeah.
14 innings. Who was my game five starter?
Wouldn't it have been Eric Kirch?
No, because he would have been on short rest, and he wasn't responding.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah. He went game two. So
he went game two, so he would have been on even shorter rest. That's right. I don't know who that starter would have been either.
Ryan Flores.
I have no idea.
Ryan Flores?
We were going to have a bullpen day. That's what we were going to do for game five. Well, I just pitched Poberako three innings going into that last inning, so he was toast, okay? I had Velez pitch two innings, okay? He was good for maybe one the next day. Ryan Flores was warmed up. It probably would have been like a Flores and then a Gerken and then maybe sprinkle Karch in there for an inning or two. We had no idea, to be honest. We had no idea, but once we got into that tie situation, we were trying to win that game. And that was the scary thing about losing Carlos, because he was our game one starter. And the crazy thing is he had to leave the next day. So he couldn't even have pitched game two. It just so happened that once we figured this out, we set up our rotation so that if we did make the playoffs, he would start game one and then he could then leave to be out, and it just kind of worked out that way.
Wow. Well, you know, I gotta say, Steve, I did not realize that we've already been here like an hour and 15 minutes. This time is going by so incredibly quick. But, what we've been doing is we've been allowing, we usually kind of have Kevin give a final thought, but you're our guest tonight, so we'd like to let you give us a final thought to take the show out for tonight.
Well, my final thought is that behind all these managers in our league, and we have great managers, is always a better woman. And I just want to give a shout out to my wife, and all the wives that allow us to do the job that we do, because what their sacrifice is that they give up, their time with their husbands, their time, as a family, so that we can live out our dreams and live out our, I call it fantasy baseball sometimes, because that's kind of what we do. We build it, we do it, and we have fun doing it. So there's, even though we have great managers in the league, I guarantee, and I haven't met all the wives, but I guarantee we have a lot of great wives in this league, and I'd like to give a shout-out to them, because I know it's very hard on the 5 months that I leave that my wife becomes a single mom with a now 16-year-old and going to be a 13-year-old. So big kudos to her. And all the wives that allow us to do what we do. Even, you guys, what you guys do, you guys spend a lot of time on this phone doing your podcast, and Rob traveling everywhere. And Rob, I know you're at like every sporting event that, cause I follow you on Twitter. So, our wives deserve a lot of credit for allowing us to fulfill our dreams and to allow us to do what we love to do.
Well, I think a lot of cases for me, Steve, my wife's like, are you leaving this week? I'd really kind of like to have the house to myself. No, that's not true. that's not true.
On a funny note, I have been married since 2003, so that's how many years now? So that'll be
16
years. Yeah, it'll be 17 years in January. and probably because I leave for 5 months is how I've been able to stay married for so long.
What's the anniversary? What anniversary date?
Yeah, oh man, quit putting me on the spot. Robbie's killing me right now. January. Oh boy. I believe it's January 30th. I believe.
Okay, so we're 4 days apart then. Okay.
Yeah, so. January 30th, I believe. No, probably. Hopefully, she doesn't hear this podcast.
Well, you run her over with that big final thought. So
yeah.
She can't be too mad about that there.
Right.
So.
My wife's catchphrase is "Mama don't like no clinging vine." So if I'm at the ballpark and I'm out of her hair, I'm not bugging her about anything. She's happy as long as she's got her murder shows on. She's got her murder shows on TV to watch. She has a gun permit. She shoots her guns a lot. So personally, I think she's eventually plotting out my eventual demise. But we're happy, you know. She's got her stuff going on, and I'm at the ballpark and in my personal bliss. So
yeah,
it's all good.
Oh, there's that old adage, man. Happy life, happy life.
Absolutely.
So, you know, we do, but they deserve a lot of credit.
Absolutely. That's a great final thought there, Steve. Well, we want to thank manager Steve Montgomery for joining us this week. For Kevin Lucco, I am Rob Pannier, and we will see you next time on This Week in the Association.